Good morning, good evening, wherever you are across the world and the universe. Welcome to my Quantum Living Podcast, at the intersection of science and spirituality. I'm your host, Anna Anderson, quantum coach and teacher, intuitive guide, and above all, an inquisitive soul. This podcast is about how we can bring the various spiritual, metaphysical, and esoteric concepts validated by quantum physics and modern cosmology to the very practical level to improve and enrich our life experience as individuals, communities, and the humankind. Whether you are listening to this show while driving or commuting, doing chores around the house, relaxing on a couch, or flying in a spaceship across the galaxy, I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. Okay, let's begin. Hello and welcome back to Quantum Living. I have published dozens of episodes on this podcast on NDE, the afterlife, psychic phenomena, angels, consciousness, mediumship, and channeling, as these are the topics of my interest and the core of the show. I am fairly knowledgeable in these subjects based on my own research and personal experience, plus all that I have learned from my guests so far. So at some point, I begin to think that there is really nothing new I could learn and bring on the show to my audience without repeating the same story, perhaps in a different context or from a different angle. So I waited for something special, for a story that will make my jaw drop. And I can tell you that this is a tall order. Until one day, not long ago, when watching Gaia, that's exactly what happened. The interview was riveting, gathering the momentum, and at one point, my jaw did drop to the floor. I instantly knew I had to invite that guest to my show, as what I saw and heard was beyond amazing. Luckily, he graciously accepted my invitation, so fasten your seatbelts, folks. My very special guest today is Daniel Drazen. Daniel is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, photographer, and media producer who's been working in this field for over six decades. Since the early 1990s, Daniel has been actively investigating afterlife communication through traditional mental and physical mediumship, as well as modern electronics. He has produced groundbreaking documentaries Calling Earth and Skull, The Afterlife Experiment, which present an irrefutable evidence of the survival of human consciousness after death. He is also the author of A New Science of the Afterlife book, published in June 2023, which we will talk about, as well as about these two amazing documentaries, which are in the category of must-see, as far as I'm concerned. Trust me, I have seen them. Hello, Daniel. Welcome to Quantum Living. It's such a pleasure to have you on my show.
Thank you, Anna. It's a great pleasure for me as well. And thank you for that wonderful introduction.
My pleasure. Oh, gosh, I'm thrilled to be able to speak with you. Not long ago, as I mentioned, I was watching your interview on Gaia with Regina Meredith, where they showed a couple of clips from these documentaries that I've mentioned. And my jaw did drop to the floor. And it doesn't happen very often, if ever. So, wow. As I said, they are a must-see category of films. But let's start from the beginning. How did you become interested and involved in this field?
It's hard to say exactly when, but my interest in the so-called paranormal, and I say so-called because who knows how normal these things are if we can't talk about them comfortably. But my first such experiences really took place when I was very young, as a child, when I had a number of precognitive dreams, dreams that came true in one way or another very shortly after the dream. And I didn't understand what this was. It puzzled me, and I thought it was quite interesting and fascinating, actually. But what it did teach me was that in the theater of life, stuff goes on backstage, that there are levels of reality that are not obvious on the surface. Now, we all know that from, simply from Western science for the past 400 years, which has been, probing into levels of nature that are not obvious to our senses. And this should tell us that there's more. There's always more. So this became a, I sort of integrated this perspective into my life as I grew up. I then became quite interested in the question of alien life, became an avid student of the whole UFO question. Both the phenomena itself and also the fascinating political efforts that have been underway for decades, to try to keep the lid on this. I'm sure I don't have to tell your listeners too much about that. But so that was another aspect of reality that taught me that, again, more stuff goes on backstage than we can imagine. So long story short, back in the 1990s, I met a gentleman by the name of Mark Macy, who had just written a book about instrumental transcommunication, communication with the other side through electronics. And at first, I was actually a bit skeptical about this, but I soon overcame my skepticism after meeting a number of people who practice this form of communication, hearing many of the samples that they have recorded over the years. And then I sort of became a student of this phenomenon. In the early 2000s, I teamed up with co-producer Tim Coleman, and we actually made two documentaries together. The first one is Calling Earth, which is about this process of communication, receiving communications from the other side through electronics. This, as far as we know, the first evidence we have of this came from the 1950s. Now, in the 1950s, tape recorders became consumer items for the first time. And people would, record their playing piano at home, recording their kids' voices. Sunday preachers would record their priceless words of wisdom on tape, and so on. And, this was considered a common household appliance at the time. From time to time, people would hear on their tapes faint voices that didn't belong there. Didn't make sense. They were not heard during the recording process. And in the United States, for the most part, these were dismissed as sort of odd artifact. Well, maybe the machine was picking up a radio station or something like that. And no one paid much attention to it. But in Europe, it was a different story. A number of serious researchers, scientists, physicists, and others became involved in analyzing and practicing this form of communication. The first, as far as we know, was a man named Friedrich Jurgensen. He was a Swede, very well known in his time as an artist, a filmmaker. He was even an opera singer and writer. And he was in the process of making a documentary at the time. And he went out with his new tape recorder at night to record nocturnal bird sounds. And when he played back the tape in the pauses between the nocturnal bird sounds, he heard faint voices discussing nocturnal bird sounds. And now this, he thought this was quite a coincidence and figured, well, maybe the machine was picking up a radio broadcast of people discussing nocturnal bird sounds. But very soon thereafter, he heard on one of his tapes, the voice of his mother calling him by his childhood nickname, Friedel.
Wow.
And that really got his attention. So at that point, he said, well, this is something we really need to investigate scientifically. So he spent years collecting these samples. He would simply roll the tape. He would ask a question, leave some blank time on the tape, ask another question, and so forth. And when he played back the tape, most of the time, there would be these faint voices providing plausible answers to his questions. So a few years later, he was joined by a Latvian professor named Konstantin Raudova, who worked with Jurgensen for a time, then went off and did his own experiments in what's called electronic voice phenomenon, which is a subset of this instrumental transcommunication. And Raudova went off, did his own experiments, and by the time he had passed on in 1974, he had recorded between 60 and 70,000 examples of these voices. He had published a phonograph record that reproduced quite a number of these voices on tape, where he had asked a question, and then the response comes, and it was quite audible and really fascinating. Then after Radhava passed on, he then showed up in the communications of his colleagues. And he had most of these electronic voice samples only run a few seconds, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 seconds at the most. It's evidently a very difficult phenomenon to pull off from the other side. Who knows what the levels of resistance and frequency issues are involved. But Radhava uniquely was able to maintain long conversations running several minutes. He communicated with a friend of mine in Colorado, this Mark Macy, a number of practitioners in Europe. He spoke 6 languages. Most of the communications we have from him are in English and German. And his speech patterns are quite normal and natural and relaxed and authoritative. So this is evidence that's really quite impossible to question or to undermine once you really get familiar with the field. So back to the film project, Tim Coleman and I went across the United States to 3 or 4 European countries over a period of almost 10 years and recorded quite a number of interviews with people who have been practitioners in this field. And you can see this all in my documentary, Calling Earth, which is both on Vimeo and we recently put it up on YouTube. So that's the story in a nutshell. If you have any more questions about it, I'll be glad to elaborate.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. We will talk about a number of those aspects in this conversation. And I will, of course, include in the show notes the links to both those movies, to your books and your online presence. I have watched both documentaries. And as I said, they are jaw-dropping as far as I'm concerned. I like the quote in your book by Ansel Adams, legendary photographer. A good photograph is knowing where to stand. As a professionally trained photographer myself, I understand that the point of view is everything. It dictates what you will see on the photograph, whether it's a close-up, macro, or wide angle, and of course, the position of the camera in relation to the subject. And beautifully, this principle applies to pretty much everything in life, I would suggest, as a metaphor for our own individual point of view, our filter with beliefs, assumptions, and expectations. Your book and your documentaries are about, broadly speaking, a proof of the survival of human consciousness after death. What perspective did you choose to present the evidence and the arguments to validate this premise? In other words, what is your point of view? What is your approach to treating this subject matter, which is obviously huge?
Well, you might say there's 2 parts to it. One is the spiritual, even the existential point of view, which comes down to the question of whether we are bodies who have souls or souls who have bodies. The normal point of view in our materialistic culture is that we are bodies who may or may not have souls. And at best, we might have a soul. Whatever that is, you know, but from a metaphysical point of view or a post-materialist point of view, we are souls who have bodies. And I think that our everyday experience of life is very different if we come from one point of view or another there. My personal point of view, after all these years of looking into it and looking into my own experience, is that we are souls who have bodies. And from that point of view, all of these metaphysical areas of inquiry make perfect sense. So that's what's most comfortable to me, makes the most sense to me, and is in accord with my own feelings about life and my own experiences as well. So, and I'd say the other part of it is that it's important that we, particularly in the Western cultures, begin to bring science to bear on these questions. And not in the sense of necessarily what we think of as materialistic science, but the scientific method, which can really be applied to anything. And one of its basic values is that it properly conducted, it keeps us from fooling ourselves. Ideally, it gets our egos out of the way. It's not perfect, but it provides a measure of objectivity, and it provides food for thought. And I think the whole field of electronic voice phenomena and instrumental transcommunication, which also includes photographs and video and so on from the other side, these provide very, very hard evidence that can be analyzed scientifically, evaluated scientifically, and perhaps duplicated scientifically. There are some people who are working on trying to perfect or refine the technology on this side that would presumably make it easier for those on the other side to contact us. I'm agnostic about that. My personal view is that what enhances or facilitates this kind of communication has more to do with our emotional connection with those on the other side, and also factors that are really beyond our knowledge. Some people say that this form of communication works best during the waxing phase of the moon or one thing or another. And so let's experiment. Let's try to find out if these are true. And, you know, maybe we will stumble on other factors that we haven't considered that will make this form of communication more practical and more reliable and something we can use every day. There's a professor at the University of Western Ontario who's right now, he has a grant to study communications that people have been receiving on their smartphones. And I look forward to the outcome of that study. Wow. A lot of this is in the form of text messages. And I've heard many personal stories of people who have received text messages from the other side from folks who are recently deceased. So somehow they're able to, they or some intermediate faculty somehow is enabled to bridge the gap between the realm of consciousness and the material realm. And we know very little about it, but I'm sure we'll learn more to the extent that we're willing to acknowledge the phenomenon, that foundations and so forth are willing to fund these studies. That's a big thing. Yes. And hopefully we'll just become more comfortable with this whole perspective on life and death, which then hopefully will reflect back onto our everyday experience and our personal and social priorities.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Your book, as you mentioned, and your films, your documentaries, are based on science and scientific research. And after having read your book and watched your documentaries, there was just something that struck me. There is no mention or no extended treatment, at least, of the subject of spirituality. So my question is, where is the creator, or whatever name you want to use for the highest intelligence, in this picture? Where is the spirituality side of it?
This raises the question that's the subject of the longest chapter in my book, which is about semantics. What do we mean by creator? What do we mean by God? What do we mean by these various words? I think I've used the word God only once in the book, in this chapter on semantics. And I think that before we can address these questions, I think we have to step, to the extent possible, step back from our traditional definitions and imagery and so forth, and even from some of the traditional questions, which may have to be rephrased and viewed from a different angle to be able to get deeper into them. You know, you say the word God, and every 10 different people will have 10 different images of it. When we say creator, that it tends to me at least, it tends to suggest an all-powerful individual. I'd say if I have an image or a definition of the creator, it would be something closer to a hologram of infinite and eternal extent. I can diverge here just for a moment to suggest that one possible view of what we call the afterlife or the other side or beyond the veil is that of a sort of a hologram, where every point in that huge picture is, or every individual ensconced in it, is in some sense also spread out throughout the whole, but with the ability to individualize, to concentrate itself. You're probably familiar with holography in the current sense, where you have a photographic plate and a laser beam and you have interference patterns and so on. And it's a fascinating thing in its own right, but I think it's also a wonderful metaphor for what happens beyond what we call space and time, which are very, you know, limited frameworks. If you have ever in any way experienced infinity or eternity in a dream, in a psychedelic state or whatever, in meditation, I think it becomes obvious after a while that our sort of hard-coded, delimited notion of the physical world is really just a subset of something that's much freer and more creative and less frozen in space and time, you might say. And I think that is the realm in which our consciousness plays. And when I say our consciousness, from my perspective, we all participate in it. To the extent that we are conscious, we are part of that larger reality. We're sort of individual points of focus in it, but that we all participate in it. And that, to me, the nature of consciousness is completely formless. It's arbitrary until the creative principle gets going, and then you have dimensions and you know, physical creations and planets and animal, vegetable, and mineral. That's one reason why I prefer not to stick to conventional language and would much rather kind of shake things up in hopefully a more colorful and less traditional way.
Yes. And just to clarify, I don't mean to hang up on particular words or language, because we all know that our language is very limited and is very prescriptive. What I meant by asking where is the creator or spirituality in this picture that you have painted is more about the other side of science. For example, the motto for my show is at the intersection of science and spirituality. So my definition of the creator is all that is, or better still, the highest intelligence, because I think by now most scientists even have agreed that there is an underpinning intelligence in the universe. At least this is a prevailing school of thought, as I understand. It is not some haphazard event, because it is too well organized. So there is an underlying and underpinning intelligence in it. So that's what I'm referring to, not God as taught by some religions, you know, an individual or power that is more defined, but all that is. And some spiritual schools of thought refer to the creator God as all that is, which I think represents that consciousness, intelligent, highly intelligent consciousness, from which all has been created, all has come. That was my angle, if you like. But thank you for explaining.
To me, what each of us has said is simply a different expression of the same thing.
Yeah. Yes.
That there is a universal intelligence, a universal consciousness, from which a universal intelligence has emerged, and that intelligence has been playing creative games with itself for all of eternity.
Yes.
And this is the question of infinity and eternity is something that's really gotten to fascinate me in recent years, because I quite unexpectedly had an experience of eternity. I was just sitting at my desk watching a YouTube video one day, and without going into so much, without a lot of detail about it, I suddenly found myself experiencing eternity. And one side of my brain was counting the seconds. It happened for about 30 seconds of Earth time, you might say. But the rest of my awareness was just stunned. And the only thing I could say to myself was, oh my God, eternity is not merely an infinite extension of time. It's something absolutely and completely different. Now, this realization of the eternal or the boundless is beginning to sneak up on our culture in some interesting ways. The James Webb Space Telescope, for example, has been out there for not very much time now, and it's beginning to lay waste to a lot of preconceptions about how the physical universe was created. But it's also done another interesting thing that, as I understand it, there has been a very quiet branch of cosmology that's called eternalism. It's been around for a while, but hasn't really shown its face very much. And my understanding is that the eternalists are beginning to come out of the woodwork now and say there may be no beginning and no end. And that is challenging to our minds because our minds have to slice and dice things, measure them, create beginnings and ends, whether they're there or not, you know, in order to package them for our human comprehension. But beyond the realm of human comprehension, there's probably still plenty of comprehension left, and that level of comprehension can be very comfortable with the notion of eternity. And I think for that reason, you know, those on what we call the other side are much more tuned into things like past lives, past civilizations, other civilizations, and so on. It's just no big deal over there.
Yes.
And forgive me for using the expression over there, because that's another kind of spatial metaphor. I work with a talented team of mediums who are always reminding me that our friends on the other side aren't often some distant realm in the sky. They're all around us. Just as, you know, as you and I are sitting here in our homes, there are 1,000 radio and television broadcasts and wireless communications going through our room and through our bodies at all times, but they don't exist, you know? So, and this raises the question of what's the veil? We speak about, you know, the other side is beyond the veil. What's the veil? As far as I'm concerned, the veil is our senses, our physical senses. And, you know, ultraviolet light is beyond the veil in the same sense that heaven is beyond our senses. You know, once we start thinking in terms of different frequencies or levels of reality, I think this clears up a lot of the mystery. And I think, and I hope that it changes our language a bit, that to become a little more, you know, perhaps a little less traditional, a little less anthropomorphized, and more open. And that would stimulate us to actually experience things in a different way.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. In relation to that sense of eternity that you spoke about, I have a feeling that this is the zone that we can go into. For example, when we are engrossed in some creative activity, or even in meditation, when we can lower our brain waves down to the theta state, in which we can experience that no space, no time, no personality, simply pure consciousness in the whole of creation, the whole being. Because that's the point where there is no time, no space, just a sense of belonging, a sense of being part of the greater consciousness or the great reality, as you call it. So are we talking about the same thing here? Because this is this, when I go into the zone or in my meditation, that's exactly the space that I find myself in, where there is no beginning and no end.
That would represent sort of the other extreme of where we are normally are in our sensibilities and our civilization and so on. That would be the other pole of it. There is also in between the two levels of relative reality that you know, those of us who study this field are familiar with. Those who communicate from the afterlife, for example, they're in sort of what I would call one of the intermediate levels, where they have both a greater sense of the eternal, but also a connection with manifest reality, with our physical world, with human connections, and so on. There are those, for example, this team of mediums that I mentioned that I work with, we're located in different parts of the country, and so we often have Zoom meetings. And our meetings are often crashed by none other than Robin Williams.
Who is really?
A, who, Really. He's actually working with a lot of mediums, but he's worked with us.
Wow.
And he can be incredibly hilarious. I mean, you can't make him up. And then he can get very, very serious. And he's told us about his own struggles when he was alive here with his disease, with his family, and so on. And he says that he has chosen to stay close to the earth plane, and that he feels that his mission in doing so is to help us lighten up, God's sake, and stop taking life so seriously. I could go on and on about this, but that's basically the idea, that there are some folks who leave this earth plane and go on to higher, more subtle levels. Others choose to stick around to be of assistance to us in our own evolvement, and sometimes even in some of the practical aspects of our lives. Speaking of Robin Williams, I live in Marin County, California, which is just north of San Francisco, just over the Golden Gate Bridge. And there's a tunnel in the freeway there that was, after Robin Williams died, it was named after him. It's the Robin Williams Tunnel. So in one of these contacts, I said to him, I said, you know, every time I drive through this tunnel, I think of you. And he says, oh, the tunnel. He says, every time, he says, I love standing in the middle of the tunnel with my arms outstretched and watching the cars go through me. Now, you can't make this up. So, yeah, and he and others have kind of elbowed their way into our meetings. And I've spoken to others as well. I recently met a young woman who's an attorney, a practicing attorney, and she has been discovering her own mediumship talents. And Robin Williams has come to her as well with a lot of detailed information. So, you know, I feel privileged to have a sort of a ringside seat at some of these developments of what I used to call paranormal. I don't know what's paranormal anymore, because we don't, you know, if we can't talk about it again, how do we know what's normal or not?
Yes.
I think people are feeling somewhat more at ease now in talking about it. And so we're finding that it's a lot more common than we might think.
Whether you are seeking professional guidance and support in getting through the challenges of life, or would like to better understand how life really works, why not consider one of my Quantum Living transformative programs? Quantum Shift, Healing Emotional Addictions, Healing Relationships, Finding Your Mojo, or Quantum Living Mentoring Program, my newest addition. They are all based on quantum science and metaphysics, my extensive coaching experience, quantum wisdom, energy healing, and psychic insights. Please visit quantumliving.com.au for more information and contact details. Let's have a chat how I could help you find what you are looking for. You'll be glad you did. I think one of the reasons is that people tend to be afraid of things they don't understand, which is, a natural psychological response. What we don't understand, what is unfamiliar to us, we are very cautious because we don't really know how to deal with it. So I feel that this is one of the reasons for, if you like, resistance or separation between the normal, what we know very well and understand and can live it and deal with it, versus concepts and situations and ideas and phenomena that we can't understand with our five main physical senses. I think it's now a good point to share my own experience.
Please.
And I would be curious to hear your view on this. Just as a background, I am fairly psychic, or I have a very good intuition, and I'm open psychically in various ways. But this was very unusual. It happened several years ago. I was working on my computer, and I have, which is a desktop PC, and I always have external speakers connected to my computer. And I remember that I was just typing something. I finished working, and I got up. I had no music on. There was no media running, nothing. I was just in Word typing some document. I got up, and then I heard a voice coming from the computer speakers, loud and crystal clear. Hello, with this sort of intonation, hello, but just once. It was a male voice, and I would characterize it as a handsome voice, if you like. And I froze, and then I said, hello, hello, who are you? Hello. And then I said, you know, said a few other things, just inviting conversation. Please talk to me. Please talk to me. And there was silence. So I kept talking to my computer for the next 15 minutes or so, hoping that the source of this voice comes back and engages in a conversation with me. But it was just a single, but very clear, very loud, hello, in male voice. And for some reason, I got an insight or a thought at that point that they were time traveler and just somehow got energetically connected with my device, if you like, and they were looking for communication. But beyond that one hello, which was, as I said, with an intonation seeking response, seeking anyone there, hello, and there was just one. And I was so upset that they were gone and didn't want to, you know, keep talking to me. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't be too sure that they didn't want to keep talking to you. See, we don't understand the process. We don't understand how this happens. We don't understand. Sometimes I use the metaphor of, let's say there are two railroad trains traveling on tracks that are not quite parallel. They converge and diverge and converge and diverge. And there's only one open window in each train. And the trick is to throw a spitball between one open window in one train into the other, right? On those rare moments when the two windows happen to be, you know, aligned. I think that's part of the picture, that we're dealing with energy systems that are foreign enough to our own.
It makes sense.
You know, depending on which way the etheric breeze is blowing, if you want to put it that way, communication will be more or less possible. Mm-hmm. In the Skoll experiment, which we can talk about for a minute, which is the subject of my other documentary, mm-hmm. one of the folks on the other side communicating with the team on this side, this is someone who was able to make his voice just come out of thin air, not through technology or through the mediums. He was able to just project his voice out of the air. And he was asked, you know, how do you do this? And he says, well, you know, I think in a language that I'm familiar with, and by some miracle, the voice is transmitted into your room. But he added, it says, not by me, but by entities whose job it is to do that.
Wow.
So there may be, at least in some instances, those entities who are able to bridge that gap in frequency, or whatever you want to call it. Again, we understand so little about the mechanisms, but we do know how to enhance the possibility of this kind of communication occurring. All else being equal, if you have an emotional bond with someone on the other side, if you try to make contact at the same time of day every day, try to set up patterns that are likely to be more perceptible to those on the other side, that the possibility of making this communication happen will be enhanced. But I think that's all we can say at this point. We understand some of the conditions that we can set up. Who knows, and maybe certain geographical areas are more susceptible to this kind of phenomenon. You know, if this were much more acceptable to the scientific community, we'd probably know by now that, you know, there would be, you know, huge sources of funding for research and experimentation in these areas. We're not there yet, obviously. Just speaking of the Skoll experiment, I did want to mention that while we still have time. Then this is the subject of the other documentary that I did with Tim Coleman. Skoll experiment is an experiment in physical mediumship that took place mostly in the latter half of the 1990s in a tiny town in England called Skoll. It's in the county of Norfolk, about a half hour northeast of Cambridge. And in that village, in a particular wonderful old 17th century farmhouse, there was a very quiet old wine cellar. These two couples were able to create an environment where, for a period of almost 5 years, they did 500 sessions sitting around this particular table in this cellar, and they managed to have an enormous success in contacting, communicating with the team on the other side, with whom they worked in concert to develop experiments in communication between the realms. And these included, you know, not just mediumistic communication, but physical manifestations, voices, which I had mentioned that just came right out of the air, not through the mediums. They did a series of electronic experiments. This is during a period where, for 2 years, this experiment was monitored by three experts from the British Society for Psychical Research. And these were properly skeptical investigators. They'd heard and seen it all, and yet they could find absolutely no evidence of any tampering or fakery or anything like that. They also were curious about some of these experiments that the team was attempting. One of which involved using a little tape recorder from which the microphone had been removed, so there'd be no chance of recording any sounds from the room. And yet they were receiving voices through this tape recorder. They were then advised how to build a device which would enhance the communications, which it did to some extent. And then when they asked, is there a way to improve this device still further, they received a message in a most interesting way. Part of their experimentation was using photographic film, unexposed photographic film, which those on the other side would impress writing and pictures and poems and wonderful drawings and puzzles. You've seen that in the documentary.
Yes.
So the question was asked, how can we improve this device? So what appeared on the next roll of photographic film was a diagram showing how to improve this device. And it was signed with the letters TAE, which were an exact match to Thomas Alva Edison's signature.
Wow.
So presumably the spirit of Edison was lurking behind the scenes and lending his expertise to the enterprise there, and it goes on and on. And this was documented in my film called Skoll, the Afterlife Experiment, which you have seen.
Yes, and that was the moment that made my jaw drop to the floor when I saw that on the blank tape. Under very strict monitoring and conditions when the tape was developed, and it is shown in the movie, there is a string of writings, photographs, graphics. I mean, that's the moment when my brain froze. And if someone, after seeing this, and as you said, this has been documented and reported, etc. If someone, after seeing this and accepting this as a fact, in other words, there was no tampering, there was nothing, you know, funny going on, to me, this in itself is an irrefutable evidence. You can't refute it. It wasn't there, and then there was. So if someone, after seeing this, still claims that, oh, you know, there was a fluke or whatever, there's no such thing as interdimensional communication, well, I think they need to think again, because this is irrefutable. And this, in fact, is a very nice segue to my next question. As you said in your book, the landscape of afterlife research includes several phenomena such as NDE, reincarnation, life between lives, mediumship, out-of-body experience, and instrumental transcommunication, and many others. The main difference that I can see amongst all those avenues, if you like, is that some experiences are subjective to the experiencer, while others can be objectively tested. And instrumental transcommunication, obviously, is a good example in this category. So my question is, when looking at those two groups, if you like, of phenomena, in your view, are some more reliable as evidence of such phenomena than others in terms of objectivity and subjectivity?
Well, I'm certainly, in terms of objectivity, The ones that can be objectively demonstrated are obviously more solid evidence or proof, if you will. But the same thing is true in our physical lives. We have many subjective experiences. I mean, I can't prove that I had a certain dream last night, but enough of us have dreams that we can relate to, at least to the existence of the phenomenon. So in that sense, I think that we're not as aware that that question exists in our normal lives, but it does. You know, I mean, there's no way that I can know how you experience anything. We have an arena of objective exchange and phenomena. I think you and I both agree that we can see each other on Zoom right now, but I have no idea how you perceive me or your environment or anything. I have no idea what your memories are like. It's, you know, there's what we perceive, and there's also what we notice or don't notice. And this is something I get into in my book briefly, that, I mentioned that there's a street that I've driven on thousands of times, and only last year did I notice a particularly remarkable tree that's been growing by that street for decades, and I never noticed it. And then one day, for some reason, I noticed it, and now that tree is real to me. It was not real to me before.
Yeah.
So this also gets into the question of, this gets into the question of how we define reality. And this is something in my chapter on semantics. I take a crack at defining reality, and I won't give it away right now. But I think it's a very important thing to question, because we use words like that. You know, take any two people who disagree about anything, and you'll find that they have different definitions of reality. So many arguments and diversities of opinion have to do with language. So I think we need to start seeing through that. I mean, we can't discard language. We need it, at least so far. But I think language can be as much of an impediment as anything else. And I think those of us who are at all bilingual, for example, can appreciate that some languages have words for things that other languages don't.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
When you hear some bilingual over here in a cafe, some bilingual people conversing, very often they'll switch from one language to another because one language expresses something better or may actually have an expression for something that the other one completely lacks. So that's, I think, one of the ways in which we need to expand our consciousness is to take a look back at what we think of as ordinary in our lives. And you look at it with some objectivity and question, you know, the way we've arranged our reality. Is that the only way to arrange reality? I don't think so.
Yes. Yes, very, very good point. Thank you. I have one more question about mediumship, which is perhaps somewhat controversial, but I am aware that a number of people share my view on this, if you like. And that is, I know that channeling and mediumship are real from my own experience and from my own understanding of these phenomena. But I have to say that I am always skeptical about someone claiming that they channel a specific entity or group of entities, which they identify by their name, for example. And I must say that I feel this can be often just for marketing and commercial purposes, because if you say that you channel, say, Archangel Michael or an entity XYZ, you are more likely to get followers and a lucrative business of channeling sessions than if you said that you are channeling the spirit or your higher self. And I don't mean to be critical or dismissive of those channels who choose to identify their source of information, but I am always skeptical. So what is your view on this?
Well, it's a very good question. And it's something that I run into all the time myself. And I think, I don't know that there's a single blanket answer to that. I think probably several different things are going on. I think from the other side, if there is a teacher or a presence or a team that wants to get certain points across, they may engage in some what I call benevolent masquerading to add authority to their presence in some way, depending on who's receiving it and who would respond to that identity. Well, I'm saying in some cases there may be misinformation being transmitted, and in other cases perhaps something completely different beyond our conception is going on.
Okay.
I think the bottom line for us is to treat it the same way as we would treat information from human beings. You know, try it on for size, see if it fits right, if it feels right. You know, try acting on it and see what happens. And if it doesn't feel right, don't do it. I don't think, you know, so-called dark spirits are capable of much more mischief than humans are, God knows. So, you know, I think if we think of these things in a more ordinary rather than extraordinary way, that will be more wisely guided. Obviously, for those of us who can't directly see beyond the veil, as it were, you know, some caution and discernment is always advisable. You know, if individuals are going to use their positions of authority to be manipulative, they'll probably, you know, call in the right spirits to further that enterprise. You know, not everyone on the other side is, you know, wears wings. So everything comes down to our own discernment in our ordinary life, and in probing into these other areas. We need food tasters to give us just a, you know, a tiny bit of this, see if it feels right, and then proceed. And if we see any red flags, then back off. It's just, you know, that's just how this common sense, I would say, is the best teacher there. And again, if we think of this as esoteric or holy, we are likely to suspend our normal sense of discernment. We don't want to give authority to any external agency, no matter what it calls itself. And I think the more we do that, the more we're likely to be approached by those beings and entities and spirits and human beings that are, you know, are genuinely interested in everyone's well-being.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. Now, I found in your book an elegant explanation of the question I've been grappling with for many years, which is, if souls keep reincarnating, how is it possible to communicate with someone who passed, say, 500 years ago and would have reincarnated, hopefully, or possibly a few times since then? And so there are, let's say, five different personalities of the soul within that time frame. And what you said in your book is that a soul, while incarnating, always remains in the greater reality as a fragment containing the memories and personality of each incarnation, which can independently communicate with people on this side. Could you please elaborate on this? Because I know that many people ask this question. How is it possible?
From my perspective, and I could be wrong, the soul as a whole, your soul, my soul, doesn't really have boundaries as such, right? Or it has very permeable boundaries, you might say. So the identity of a given soul may itself have a certain flexibility to it. Those aspects of it that reincarnate and then are drawn back would seem to add to the sum total of the soul's experience. And as these continue more and more reincarnations, the experiences are absorbed into the whole of the soul. That's how I tend to view it, rather than fragments. When we address someone, say a loved one of ours who passes, and we make contact with them by whatever means, the aspect that we're most familiar is the one that will resonate with us quite naturally. But depending on how long they've been over there, they could be more and more integrated into their greater self and be capable of giving us a wide variety of information, both about their lifetime just lived and about others. For example, my late partner, Jane, who passed in 2007, I've had several conversations with her through two trusted mediums since then. And her progress has been interesting. In the first short period after she passed, I was physically aware of her presence because I would, like at the end of the day, I'd be in the kitchen washing up, and she would always be there standing next to me. And I could feel it. And I would have this strong tingling in the right side of my head when she was present. It was really quite something. Sometimes I thought the top of my head was going to come off. So that happened for a period of time. And then at a certain point, she was no longer that close to the earth plane, that accessible. And in several conversations I've had with her through these mediums, I learned about her, you know, where her sense of identity kind of shifted from being more oriented toward the earth plane to moving then into what we call the life review, more insight about the experiences of the life just lived, and then into a larger domain after that. So I sort of see these various aspects and sets of experiences of the self as sort of nested within one another, that none of these are ever lost. I think the most important question here, again, comes back to, are we bodies who have souls or souls who have bodies? And if we come from the point of view of souls that have bodies, and perhaps more than one body at the same time, which we're told occurs as well, I think what I'm saying is that our human minds are not quite prepared to encompass the ontology of this. All we can do is put labels on it that are familiar to us. That may be a very indirect way of answering your question, but I think it's the best we can do. We're just learning right now. We as individuals, and of course our culture as a whole, is just, you know, beginning to put better labels on all these things. And I think this will continue to evolve over the next decades and hopefully centuries, where the two sides of the veil, as it were, will become closer, more accessible to one another. And perhaps at a certain point, it will all become one thing. That would be my hope. And I think I'm accurately perceiving a trend in that direction. But that's just my perception.
I agree. And what you have just said absolutely resonates with me and makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. So thank you. And again, I encourage everyone interested in this topic, even remotely at this point in time, to get hold of your book and read the book and absolutely watch those two documentaries. And I will include the links in the show notes. Before we start wrapping up, Dan, I have just one final point or question that I would like to put to you. I absolutely love the concept in your book of paradise islands in the ocean of consciousness that can be anything created by the souls with thought and intention, as this again makes perfect sense to me and validates various messages from the other side that we receive about the lifestyle, for the lack of a better word, of the souls living on the other side, which they often describe as just like here on Earth. So this concept of creating those realities, those paradise islands, exactly the way as the souls want to create with thought and intention, I find absolutely fascinating. And my question here is, because it's so evocative, and I already know what my paradise island I would want to create once they passed over. But my question here is, where did this specific information come from? Can you recall?
Well, I think many of those who speak about life on the other side have told us about, you know, levels of the afterlife where souls engage in communal creative efforts of you know, working together towards a mutually recognized goal. Some of these creations mimic their physical lives that they recall on Earth, cities, towns, and etc. That look and feel very much the same as they did here. Some may choose to co-create rural environments. Some purely creative abstract environments. As I think you've probably seen, what's the film that Robin Williams starred in What Dreams May Come, where the whole environment was like a living painting, for example, as there is in any field of art. We're talking about fields of unlimited creation. Some may exist for millions of our years, and others may be created just to see what they feel like and then blow them up and start something new. So I think probably our own arts, our graphic arts, our performing arts may give us a clue as to what can happen directly in consciousness without having to deal with without physical materials and the limitations of the physical world. Are you familiar with Leslie Flint? He was a British, very famous British medium. You can Google this up on the internet. He did a long channeling once of Frédéric Chopin, and was a well-known classical composer. And it's a wonderful, he describes his experience of going to the other side and perceiving himself inside this huge concert hall with this beautiful piano and performing for the crowd. And so on and so on. I think we can replicate any familiar physical environment we want individually and collectively. We can create things that have never existed. And if we want, we can create nothing at all. We can just go into infinity and eternity where there is no structure. So it's all, it's all at the behest of the soul and what the soul is inclined to do. And it's like what to say about the other side, it's a free country. I think if our own politics were more modeled on how things happen on the other side, we would have freer countries in general.
yes, I agree with you. And I feel that one of the key takeaways from this concept is that our thought and intention do create our reality, even on this side.
I would agree.
Beautiful. Any final thoughts before we close?
Oh, I don't know. I just want to thank you for this opportunity. This has been a wonderful, wonderful hour spent, hour plus spent together. I appreciate the questions you've asked. I appreciate the thoroughness with which you have read my book and watched the documentaries. Not many people have done that, and that's very special. And all I can say is to keep up the good work.
Well, thank you so much. And not only what I have read and saw, not only has validated a lot of my own assumptions and my own thinking and understanding, but as I said at the beginning, to me, what you captured on your documentary is an irrefutable evidence of the survival of human consciousness after death.
I would agree. Thank you.
Wonderful, Dan. So thank you so very much for this amazing conversation, this amazing dialogue, and thank you for your work. So please keep doing what you do. And I would love to hear about your new projects, new books, because this is the area of our life that we absolutely need to learn much more about. So thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you on Quantum Living.
Well, it's been a pleasure. And thank you so much, Anna. And blessings to you for your work as well. That's so important.
Thank you so much. That's all for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you really loved it, please post a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to encourage others to listen to it. For the show notes, guest and podcast info, reviews, comments, and much more, please visit quantumlivingpodcast.com. And if you'd like to dive deeper into quantum living and explore how you could work with me, please contact me, and I'd be delighted to help and support you on your quantum journey. I am your host, Anna Anderson. I look forward to connecting with you in the next episode of Quantum Living. Until then, keep your vibrations high and be well.